Michael King shoves as the Padres are the only home team to win on day one of the postseason. We'll break down all the action on this episode of First Pitch. Yes, welcome on in to First Pitch for Wednesday, October 2nd. I'm your host, Lindsey Crosby. You can follow me on Twitter at Crosby Baseball. He's Christian Rau. You can follow him on Twitter at Christian S. Rau, R-A-U-H. And Christian, great first day of the postseason. A lot of surprises here, right? Three of the four road teams, so the lower seeded teams, are successful in their games, get the wins. The lone exception is the final game of the night, where the San Diego Padres take down the Atlanta Braves 4-0. And I want to start there, not because I'm a Braves guy, I am, but I want to start there because I think the most dominant performance I think we saw all night, all day, was Michael King. I'm not going to say I disparaged him, but I was not banking on him being the top starter on day one, on a day when you had Cole Reagans and Tarik Skubal and Corbin Burns and all these guys going. But after Michael King's night last night, he is the first pitcher in MLB history to strike out 12 batters with no runs or no walks allowed in his first postseason start. Just absolutely dominant. 7 innings, 5 total hits. Again, no walks, no runs. Only throws 89 pitches to get through 7 innings. Can you remember a more dominant postseason performance in recent history than this one?
No, not in recent history. I can't. Michael King, it was incredible watching that pitch. And I don't want to take too much away from him, but he got a little bit of love from the ump. I mean, when you throw that two-seamer and you're getting that bottom strike called, I mean, that's a nice little nod towards you and good help. But regardless, whether you had a different ump in there or whatever the case, he pitched phenomenal. And I'm sure we'd have still been talking about him today on how well he pitched. But 12 strikeouts is only the second best in franchise history, only one person behind Kevin Brown of the San Diego Padres for most strikeouts in franchise history in a postseason outing, which is really incredible. I think he had 16 in that outing. Kevin Brown was just insane. But Michael King,
underrated. Kevin Brown, underrated.
Super underrated guy. No one talks about Kevin Brown. But Michael King was just incredible. He made that Braves offense look exactly like we expected, Lindsey. They were a hangover offense. 15 strikeouts that entire Braves offense took. There was 3 more by Adam when he came in for relief. So, it was just a all-around good game by the Padres. They show that they are going to be a tough team in this playoffs, and we expected that. And right off the bat, Luis Arraez hits a single, surprise, surprise, and then followed by Tatis with a absolute moonshot to start the playoffs for the Padres. So I guess I'm not surprised. I'm also not surprised that Kyle Higashioka hit a home run against the Braves in the postseason either. So yeah, there's just a lot of things for these Padres teams in this playoff series that started off, and that it's just not surprising. It's unfortunate for Braves fans because you know, you make it so far and then you're going to get, you know, possibly swept by this Padres team, and it's not unexpected. But this San Diego team looks ready and poised to take on the Dodgers in the next series starting this weekend.
Yeah. On that note, since 2022, when the postseason format changed a little bit, every team who has won game one of the wild card round, like the best of three, has gone on to advance. So definitely an uphill battle now for the Atlanta Braves. On Michael King, there's something that he does, and I don't think everybody realizes how prevalent this is becoming. So if you watch him pitch, he's throwing 5 different pitches, okay? He's got 2 fastballs, both a sinker and a four-seamer. That is becoming a very common thing, to have multiple fastballs, a four-seamer and a cutter, a sinker and a four-seamer, something like that. He throws a sweeper and a slider, so he technically has 2 sliders because a sweeper is a derivative of a slider, and a changeup. But what he does that I think is just really cool that a lot of pitchers this year have started doing is platooning their pitches, right? So four-seam changeup is what he uses for opposite-handed batters, and sinker breaking ball. So sinker, sweeper, slider is what he uses for same-handed hitters. And that's a thing that I think by this time next year, every team's going to have probably two starters that do that. And it's going to be a really prevalent thing that you'll start to notice. Michael King is the guy that does that. And it helps that all of his stuff just tunnels exceptionally well. Virtually nothing is straight. Everything's moving around the strike zone. Like you said, he got a little bit of help with the strike zone last night. But still, this is something that's becoming very, very common. Not common. It's starting to become a thing across baseball. So watch for that. StatCast, in their most recent update, now when you look at the player breakdown for each pitcher, they actually show you the usage for righties and for lefties, right? That changeup, 37% of his pitches to lefties were changeups. 3% of his pitches to righties were changeups. Like, you can see the platoon usage in there versus everything else. And I just think this is a cool place for the sport to go from a pitching nerd standpoint. This is a super cool thing. And this is just another example of how pitchers are always ahead of hitters, it feels like. And hitters are always trying to catch up and find a way to produce at the plate in a league that's getting harder and harder and harder to do that.
Yeah. And the Padres were very smart. We were talking about them when we were talking about the preview, Lindsay, you know, about starting with Michael King and holding on to a guy like Dylan Cease until game three. It looks like they might not have to use him if, you know, everything works out in their favor in tonight's game. And then they have Dylan Cease ready for game one against Los Angeles. So not only did we talk about how amazing their bullpen was after the trade deadline and stuff, we might be talking about how this could be the best rotation in the playoffs when it's all said and done.
Yeah, they are absolutely they've structured everything really well. So many teams threw their aces out yesterday. I mentioned earlier, we saw Skubal, we saw Reagans, we saw Burns. They said, hey, one, we have the trust in Michael King to go out and deliver. But then two, we feel like this is a risk that we can make and we'll be okay. And we'll have Dylan Cease to take down the Padres. I'm a little bit worried about if I'm anybody else, I'm worried about the Padres coming. I think there's a very good chance they could make the NLCS, if not the World Series, just because they're fantastic. The flip side of this start was AJ Smith-Shawver for the Atlanta Braves. We talked yesterday about how they were trying to decide between three prospects. Manager Brian Snitker said in the press conference yesterday they went with AJ Smith-Shawver over Bryce Elder because of his stuff. And you saw him able to hit 98 and stuff in this game, but he started off the velocities a little bit down. That home run to Tatis was a middle fastball right about 93. And it just one of those things where it took him a couple batters to get ramped up, to get feeling like he needed to be feeling, get the velo up there, and it didn't matter. He ends up pitching one of the third innings, gives up three runs. I believe it was either a base hit and then hit by pitch or a walk and hit by pitch in the second. Then he gave up a sac fly. They pulled him after that. I do want to give kudos though to the Braves bullpen because we talked about them playing two games on Monday and that bullpen being practically just exhausted. Everybody had been used. They go Aaron Bummer, Jesse Chavez, and Luke Jackson and ask them to cover 7 2/3 innings. And in this case, it ended up being 6 2/3 because they didn't have to pitch the ninth, but one run on one hit and one walk. And that one run was the Kyle Higuita homer in the eighth on a hanging Luke Jackson slider. If you're the Braves, you sign up for four runs off of the Padres 7 days a week and Sunday after church. But with Atlanta's offense being just shut down by Michael King, it didn't matter.
Yeah, if you get four runs for the Padres, then you're probably in good shape, you know, 80% of the time, knowing that you can probably score at least more than four.
Going in with that pitching plan Atlanta had of the prospect to the third shift relievers, they like to make the jokes about the night shift in 21. I'm going to call these guys the third shift. You sign up for, yes, if we can get through this game with four runs, I'm happy with it. But the way it happened, you don't love it.
No, I agree. And I thought Bummer looked really good. I think in hindsight, you'd probably want to start off with him because he looked really good. And the way that lefties have struggled in comparison to righties for the Padres offense, I think that might have been the better choice. But regardless, I think Snitker said in the middle of the game that he wanted to try and get 13 outs from Smith Shauver, and he only got four. So right off the bat, they were already in a disadvantage. And
not great.
We'll see what happens with their pitching rotation. And tonight's game, probably won't see the quote-unquote third shift, Lindsay, because it's a do or die tonight now for the Atlanta Braves.
Yeah, Braves are sending out Max Fried, so there's your lefty. Padres are countering with Joe Musgrove. Going to be a really interesting game. That is the late game, so 8:38 p.m. Moving up a little bit in the day, I want to go to game two of the day. It was Royals versus Orioles. Orioles obviously playing at home as the top wild card. They lose 1-0 to Kansas City despite Corbin Burns. 8 innings, 5 hits, 1 run, 1 walk, 3 strikeouts. He pitches into, like, he reasonably does everything that he can, and they still can't seem to get the win here. Cole Reagans goes 6 innings, 8 strikeouts, no walks, only 4 hits. Leaves the game after only 80 pitches with some mild cramping. They said he should be fine for the ALDS should they advance. If you are Baltimore, how worried are you that you only got 5 hits, you didn't get a run in, and you are now behind in the series? How concerned are you?
Oh, you should be very concerned because almost all of the hits came from the bottom of your lineup, with the exception of Jordan Westberg. You had all of the hits from the bottom of your lineup. So nothing from Gunnar Henderson, nothing from Anthony Santander, nothing from Ryan Mountcastle, nothing from Adley Rutschman. So you should be concerned. Now, Cole Reagans did pitch a really good game as well. He had, 8 strikeouts in the matchup. But if you are looking for your first playoff win since 2014, and you are trying to make it to the next round of the postseason, something that you couldn't accomplish last year after winning 101 games, you're trying to do that this year. Yeah, you're in an elimination game against a really tough team in the Royals that is another young core just like yourself. So, no, I'd be really worried. I will shout out this, though, Cedric Mullins. A lot of people said that you shouldn't play Cedric Mullins in the starting lineup. You should put somebody else in that rotation or in the batting order, Lindsay, because going into this playoff game, he was 0-for-12 in the postseason in his career. Well, he was 2-for-3 in this one. He had a really nice double. He had a single that set up Ramon Urias to go to third base. Multiple times, Cedric Mullins in the bottom of the lineup set up the Orioles to go into scoring position, and they just couldn't get the job done. I will say that the new field dimensions of Oriole Park did change the way this game did go, though. Jordan Westberg hit a line drive out there that would have been a home run if it wasn't for the new dimensions. Also, Salvador Perez hit one that would have been out there as well. So this score should have been higher if it wasn't for the new changes to the ballpark as well.
Yeah, Baltimore out there, and you can kind of see it. This is a side note, but I am impressed with how Baltimore of all teams has done everything they can to try to juice their offensive options as far as combining, extending the wall out and up, combining that with going heavily after left-handed hitters so they can avoid it, just kind of as a run suppression measure for our opponents and a run boosting measure for us. I think that's really interesting. It's very extreme. I don't advocate other teams choosing to go out there and change their ballpark dimension just for an edge, but it's just interesting how they were willing to do that. Looking at tonight's matchup, this afternoon, 4:38 Eastern, Seth Lugo versus Zach Eflin. Do we expect this game to go any differently than game one? Is this going to be higher scoring? Are we going to see these two dudes shove? What's going to happen here, do you think?
I mean, I think we're in for kind of about the same aspects, if you will. you have both these pitchers that are very good. Seth Lugo started off his season very hot. Eflin's been very good since he's came over to Baltimore. I'm pretty sure he's got a sub 250 ERA since coming over from the Orioles. Lugo started the season off very hot. I think he cooled off quite a bit in the last couple of months, but he did pick it back up. Like, he, in August, he had a 4.91 ERA, but in September, he's back down to 2.28. So I would not be surprised to see this be pretty low scoring again. I don't think we'll have a 1-0 finish, though. I think this will be more, maybe go, I don't know, 4-3, something around there. It's going to be another close game. This team, both these teams are very evenly matched on paper, in my opinion. And I think Baltimore is going to fight. They are going to claw their way out of where they need to go. And I will say this, you know, I talked about Cedric Mullins. I think that they should move him up in the lineup tonight. They had him at the bottom of the lineup. Maybe put him in six, ride the hot bat a little bit. He did look good yesterday, Lindsay, and put maybe behind Adley Rutschman and try and score some runs, because he was really the only guy that was doing something for you yesterday. So I know that maybe he's playing with a chip on his shoulder from what people were saying about him heading into the postseason, but I think moving Cedric Mullins to the sixth spot would be smart. So I'm excited to see what the lineups look like today.
There's been iterations of that lineup before where they had him bat lead off, because there's not a lot of guys on that team that run. For being a young team, they really don't run like you think they would. Stolen base counts for the team, I want to say they have 98 stolen bases right in the middle of the pack of the American League, but only two players have double-digit stolen bases. Gunnar Henderson has 21. Cedric Mullins has 32. And so I feel like there could be an iteration of the lineup. If you feel like if you like the matchup for him versus Eflin, which he has faced Eflin before, I feel like you could go and you could put him either at one, because they've done that before. They've taken Henderson out of the one spot, or you could put him, like you said, right there in the middle, try to let him drive some stuff in. I just think him being able to get on and run a bit is maybe a little bit even more useful. So rather than being a second leadoff man, stick him either right in front of or right behind Gunnar Henderson. And they've done that. He's batted like mid-September. He was batting second behind Henderson, and then they dropped him back down. They move around a lot. Their most commonly used lineup, as far as, I'm sorry, batting order, has been used three times. They like to move this lineup around a lot. They sub guys out, they move guys around a lot. But I think he could do some stuff. They've used 144 different batting orders this year out of 160 now three games. It's a little bit absurd.
If the Orioles lose today, what do we have to talk about with this team in the offseason? Because they won 101 games last year. They had a pretty rough second half this year, but they still make the postseason as a top wild card. They have this young core. They finally made some trades. It didn't work out, but they finally made trades. What do we talk about? What is their next step if they don't win today?
Oh, I got to think about that. I think that'll end up being the Thursday show, right? Yeah. Like, if we have game threes, we talk about game threes. And if not, we talk about these teams that lost. What do they do differently? Like, there's because something's going to have to change in Baltimore. You win a division, you turn around the next year and you have the division, you're in the lead, and you lose the lead in the final month and a half. And both times, if they lose tonight, you don't win a single postseason game. And it's like, you got to do something different. But what is that something? That's the big question. So thank you for kind of keying that there. We're going to have to think about that. We have to get back to that. A team that's going to have to get back to it, who is now down, the Houston Astros dropped game one to the Detroit Tigers 3-1. Framber Valdez gives up three runs in the second inning to the Tigers. The Astros get one back in the ninth, but can't quite seem to finish everything. If you are the Astros, how worried are you that Framber Valdez couldn't even make it through five innings? Seven hits, two walks to only three strikeouts, gives up the three runs. How worried are you about the fact that you couldn't seem to get it across against Tarik Skubal and four relievers, and that now you are down 1-0 in the series?
I'm worried because I think you used your best reliever options in yesterday's game. Framber was pretty flat in that one. And then you brought out Ronel Blanco, and I thought Blanco pitched outstanding. You know, in hindsight, I think you'd probably rather have him start this game. Obviously, you're not going to do that as your game one starter, but Blanco looked really good. Even Hector Neris looked really good. I think you could
Blanco
still
did give
him
up three. Like, He didn't walk three, though. He put four guys on in his two innings. He got four strikeouts. He got out of it. But he put four on in his two innings. But, yeah, definitely a, like, Neris goes, Blanco goes. You use Josh Hader in the ninth when, again, a game. I mean, it's only 3-1. I understand you wanted to hold the lead, but the hope would be that Hader can come back out today if you have a chance to win. And if you do that, can he then pitch game three? That's a question there.
Yeah, well, really, but other than that, you know, those three runs given up in the second inning by Valdez, you know, the bullpen of the Astros kept, you know, kept the Tigers in check, even though there were some runners in scoring position. There were some times, I think Blanco even got out of a bases loaded jam, which some of those walks came into play there. But they kept them to only those three runs. Their offense couldn't do anything. I thought Jason Hayward was going to be the miracle man at the end of the game, but that didn't happen. He ripped a line drive down it, but it was right into Torkelson's glove. But you know, I think, yeah, you gotta be really worried about this Astros team right now. They might lose their first round in any playoff round since 2001, the National League Division Series, if they lose today or tomorrow. So, and we won't see them back in the ALCS. We'll have a new matchup in the ALCS that doesn't involve the Houston Astros for the first time in 8 years. If they do not make it that far, which is crazy to even think about, right? Because we've talked about how many all season long that this team is inevitable. And if they fell out in the first round, I don't know. It'd be just a really wild thing to do an ALDS preview and not talk about the Houston Astros. On the flip side, though, this Detroit Tigers team showed up. They looked really good as this young core. You know, we talked about playoff pedigree heading into this across many other teams. And we talked about how they only had 12 playoff games between the entire team, 12, this entire roster. That's it. And they go into this one and they looked pretty good. They spread out the love. They had 10 hits in this one. I will say that, we talk about this young core. One of the most underrated guys that we don't talk about, Lindsay, is Jake Rogers. That catcher on Detroit looks very good. I don't think we talk about him enough.
And that's just the mustache.
Oh, the mustache is just grade A. Don't get me wrong. I think we need to talk about that just in its own segment. But Jeremy Pena, he put down probably the one of the most beautiful bunts that I've seen ever. And Rogers took care of that with no problem. And I thought that was really impressive. He also had the first RBI single to get the scoring going in that second inning. Mm-hmm. We talk about the Parker Meadows, Spencer Torkelsons, the Riley Greens, you know, all those young guys, but I think we need to give a nod to Jake Rogers because what he's doing behind the plate and with the bat is quite impressive so far to start off this postseason.
Yeah. Every single starter in the Tigers lineup got a hit except for Spencer Torkelson, and he walked twice. So he still got on base and contributed there. Like you said, he made the defensive play. I think the scary thing for Houston is you put 16 guys on between hits and walks. Now, you did a good job at limiting the damage. Detroit went 3-for-13 with runners in scoring possession. They left 11 on base. But still, you gave them too many opportunities, and it's not sustainable to keep doing that and keep finding ways to work out of it. So I do worry a little bit about Houston being able to hold them today, especially when you consider this is Hunter Brown versus a trademark bullpen game for Detroit. They start off with Carter Holton. He'll be on the mound to start the game, but he's going to get replaced by a bunch of relievers, as they always do. I don't necessarily want to revise the prediction, but I'm starting to think Detroit's going to do this. They're going to finish it out today. It feels like they are the team of destiny. It feels like, you know, an injured Yordan Alvarez isn't quite where he needs to be to make this happen. He goes 2-for-4. Yes, one of them was a double. He didn't look to be running that well when he got in the second base.
Not at all. That could have been a triple if it was anybody else.
That could have. And then the rest of them, you look at, you know, Tucker was 0-for-4. They weren't getting enough out of the studs in this situation. And I worry that because of that, this could be it for the Astros in 2024.
When you talk about the Tigers going into a bullpen game and the game two of the wild card, that sounds concerning if you've never watched the Tigers play baseball this year. But the way that AJ Hinch has this team set up, almost every single one of his relievers coming out of the pen have been in high leverage situations at least once this year. And I think that is so key heading into this one. I don't think they're at a disadvantage in game two, even though they're starting off with a bullpen. So it's almost like it's almost like they've perfected the bullpen game. I don't know if I want to go that far with that word, but for the lack of better terms right now, that's where it seems like they're at. None of those guys have been in low leverage situations. They've all been in some tight spots, and that's helped them be ready for these moments.
You may not like it, but this is what peak bullpen performance looks like. Yeah, it's great.
I love it.
All right, jumping to the quick pitch real quick. We haven't talked about Mets Brewers yet. This is an 8-4 Mets victory. Luis Severino gets the win, despite not necessarily pitching amazingly. 6 innings pitched, 8 hits and 2 walks, gives up 4 runs, 3 of those are earned, only strikes out 3, but they get Jose Botto and Ryan Stanek to close the game out without having to go to Edwin Diaz and some of these other guys. Flip side, Freddie Peralta for the Brewers. 4 innings, 3 runs allowed. Joel Piamps takes the loss, 3 runs on 2 hits and a walk, and 2/3 of an inning. And then Aaron Ashby, obviously behind him, continues to implode. 3 hits, 2 walks, 2 runs scored, does not record an out. Aaron Civale goes out there and eats the last 3 innings of this game. Does Milwaukee have what it takes to come back and make this a series with Frankie Montas taking on Sean Manaea tonight?
Yeah, I think that Milwaukee has a chance to come back in this one, because until that 5th inning breakdown from the bullpen of the Brewers, I thought were taking care of business, and I thought they looked really good in this one. You know, they started off really strong. Their young bats look really good. Bryce Terang, 3-for-5 from the plate. He looked good. Jackson Churio had some really good rips. He also made some really good plays in the outfield. Mm-hmm. You know, having those guys as your 1-2 was pretty incredible. I would like to see Willy Adames do a little bit more from the plate, maybe a little less talking and crap talking with Jesse Winker in the outfield and more at the plate tonight. I think that would be pretty huge. And then obviously you didn't get much from Rhys Hoskins, and we talked about how we want to see him put them to bed. So get a little bit more from your veteran guys and continue to get some good stuff from your young core, and I think you'll be okay. Frankie Montas has been pretty delightful for the Brewers since he's came over in the trade from the Reds. And you know, we keep talking about these New York Mets, that this pitching squad, how surprising it's been. Sean Manaea has been pretty incredible as well. So I think we're in for a good pitching matchup. This could be one of those ones where we talk about tomorrow, that even though we have some pretty good pitchers going today, some of these names, right, like Manaea and Montas, might be the ones we're talking about as the top pitcher tomorrow.
Do we think this is probably the only series that makes it to 3 games at this point?
I think you can't rule out the Houston Astros. I think you still got to keep them involved because, you know, right, they're inevitable, right? Until they're not, I think we have to continue to say that. So other than that, I think we're going to see 2 games. I think we'll see 2 series that go to a sweep, and then we'll see 2 that go to game 3 tomorrow.
There we go. I kind of feel like I think that's the right place we should be. So, okay, I want to wrap up with the Arizona Diamondbacks. Didn't make the postseason on the final day. They weren't happy about it. At the end of the day, if you don't like it, play better. That's kind of how it works. But owner Ken Kendrick went on the Burns and Gambo radio show there in Arizona yesterday and was talking about the decision that was his. He took blame for it, for signing Jordan Montgomery. He got a 2-year, $47.5 million contract. It's an opt-in. It's a player option for 25. And I'm going to read the quote here. Looking back in hindsight, a horrible decision to have invested that money in a guy that performed as poorly as he did, referring to Jordan Montgomery here. It was the biggest mistake this season from a talent standpoint, and I'm the perpetrator of that. And then the tweet from Bob Nightingale talking about this says that Kendrick is hoping that Montgomery, who pitched to a 6.23 ERA this year, does not exercise his $22.5 million player option for 2025. That would have been higher had he made another start. They moved him to the bullpen in time for him to not get the escalator on the option to bring it up, I think, to $25 million. How dumb was this comment from an owner that most of us didn't even know who he was? I didn't know who Ken Kendrick was until this. How dumb was this comment to make out loud on the radio?
Yeah, this is the quiet thing, is that you shouldn't say out loud. This is exactly what that is. This is an inside thought, Mr. Kendrick. However, I will say I understand what he's trying to get to. I understand what he's trying to accomplish. He's trying to get Jordan Montgomery to feel like this team doesn't want him there, which is obviously clear, and him to decline his option. So they have $22.5 million to work with someone else because they don't think that money is being spent in a good spot. I see where he's going. I don't think it's going to work out in his favor, because if you're a free agent trying to sign with a team and you see that you're trying to sign a multi-year deal with options involved, why would you remotely think you'd want to go to the Arizona Diamondbacks if they're going to pull a stunt like this after one season? So I think this is going to backfire, whether Montgomery is a Diamondback this year or next year or not at all moving forward. Right. But yeah, this is a really bad call. In my mind, if you're going to take this kind of approach, saying that looking back in hindsight, it's a horrible decision and we shouldn't have invested money in a guy like this, what you're basically saying is you should not sign any free agents moving forward just in case it's a bad decision and we shouldn't invest in a guy. So yeah, this is a really bad look. I feel bad for Diamondback fans for this one, because I think this is going to change the aspect of your free agency moving forward. And I think it's going to hurt them in winter meetings. You're in a very tough division, Mr. Kendrick, and you need free agent guys. And I think this just hurts you a lot. I think it hurts you a lot more than you expected.
Yeah. The thing with this here is, and Troy and I talked about this a couple weeks ago, the decision is good or bad when you make it, right? Based on the information you have, the decision is good or bad. Then you can't look back in hindsight. If Jordan Montgomery wins a Cy Young this year, you don't get to turn like, he probably does not say it was a horrible decision, right? But that's not how this works. Was the choice to give him 22 and a half or to give him a 2-year, 40-something million dollar deal a good call or a bad call when he did it? And I think taking the blame for this signing by Ken Kendrick kind of shows that the front office didn't want to do this. They weren't planning on doing this. He was the one pushing for it. And this is something that, yes, you were willing to spend to bring in talent to try to get back to the World Series. But maybe this is a sign that you should let the baseball people make the baseball decisions. Because in retrospect, signing a pitcher that late in free agency, like they were already in spring training, if I remember right, did not work out for almost anybody. Blake Snell was atrocious the first part of the year and actually went to the minors to try to get right. Jordan Montgomery had to work through it at the major league level. He never really recovered like Blake Snell did. I think this is something where it shows you don't need to wait forever to sign these dudes. You don't really get great financial deals by waiting until February or March, and you jeopardize your team's ability to get them ready for the season, which is what happened with Montgomery, what happened with Blake Snell, a lot of these late signees. But just free agency, this is going to come back to bite them. Saying this about a player who's still under contract with you is nuts. If he was, if you had the option and you were declining the option, that would be one thing. This dude's still part of your organization. Like, the season ended the day before. They probably haven't cleaned out his locker yet. The Diamondbacks were having workouts on the field as they were watching that doubleheader in Atlanta. And so, like, you could run into him in the hall tomorrow. Such a weird decision to do. Such a weird thing to say out loud. And just baseball owners sometimes just need to shut up, get out of the way, and let the baseball people make the baseball decisions.
If I'm Jordan Montgomery, I'm saying sticks and stones will break my bones, but $22.5 million ain't going to hurt me, and I'm picking up that player option.
I'm opting in today. I'm opting in even harder now. And yeah, that's just, golly, like, bro, you gotta not do this. You gotta not say dumb things like this. Too many owners do this. They need to shut up. They need to not do that. That is brutally honest, but like just way too far. Just way too far to go. I appreciate people being honest and transparent. That was not the right way to do it. You can criticize the timing of the decision. You can criticize we didn't do a good enough job at getting him ready for the season, bringing him in late. We should have made the decision earlier to bring him in so that everybody was ready for the season. You don't get to just go and say, yeah, it was a terrible decision. It was a horrible decision and he was a mistake. That's just not how this works, man. You can't do that.
Nope, not at all. I agree.
All right. This has been First Pitch for Wednesday, October 2nd. If you're listening on audio, do us a favor. Leave us a 5-star review. If you're on YouTube. Subscribe to the channel. Hit the notification bell so you know when we drop a new episode. Either way, tell your friends that if they miss one of these games, they can turn on First Pitch and hear all about what they missed from baseball the day before. We will be back tomorrow with another episode breaking down what happened on Wednesday night and how many games we'll have on Thursday. But until then, this has been First Pitch.